5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the last week of 2007, this is the RAN Report. Just a note that our webmaster, Chris Peterson, has informed us that the duplicate postings on the archive page of therainreport.com have been corrected. You now will find Major Pat McPherson's Saturn Talk and several other programs that were among the missing have now been restored to their chronological rightful place. Thanks, Chris, for your efforts. I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK. Did you find a project kit waiting for you under the tree Christmas morning? Or are you planning on spending some long winter nights building that kit that has sat on your basement shelf for so long that it's starting to grow hair? Have you answered yes to either of these questions? This week's program is right up your soldering iron. With his talk on the tools of the kit building trade, here's veteran kit builder Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB.
The first thing that's probably the very most important is the soldering iron. I always recommend you have the stand and the sponge to keep your tip cool and keep it clean. I know a lot of guys just like to stick them on top of an ashtray, which if you're building something real small, that's not a big deal. I prefer by far having a stand and a sponge to keep that tip clean. I always emphasize that because a clean tip is a happy tip. A temperature-controlled soldering station is best, anywhere from about $35 to $150 or so. They are quite affordable. I saw several out in the flea market earlier this morning in the $40 range. Actually, real nice little Weller temperature-controlled irons. Well worth it. You can use an inexpensive iron, like one of these $7 pencil iron with a light dimmer, and that's a low-cost solution to it. The thing is, the reason you want a temperature-controlled iron is when it's sitting in the stand or out in the open when it's not being used, it gets hot, gets real hot, and when you touch it to the connection, it cools off right away. So what a temperature-controlled iron does is it keeps it at a level temperature. When you touch it to something where you're flowing solder, it raises the temperature to make sure the solder flows. When the draw is away from it, it levels the temperature so it doesn't overheat and burn the tip up. What I have used as a compromise from time to time is a $6 soldering iron, and I go to the hardware store. I went to Menards, and for $7, I picked up a line cord, a junction box, a wall socket, and a dimmer switch. And what I did was I plugged that into the wall, and I have the dimmer switch turn on and off the wall socket, and I can vary the voltage. And you can plug a voltmeter into it so you can see about what you have it set for when it's at the right temperature. And what I've done is do that, find out what it is, and then I draw lines on it so that the dimmer switch pointer is pointing where you want it to be when you're doing different things. So in a pinch, you can use one of those, but I wouldn't recommend that for a large kit where you're going to be soldering for more than a few minutes. A board holder. I really recommend if you're going to build something with a large board that use a Panavise. They're kind of expensive. They're around $90 to $100 for some of those. Some of them I've seen as cheap as $20 or $30 in flea markets, sold by people who don't even know what they are because a lot of guys don't build as much as they should. A PCB vise, it kind of looks like a miniature engine block holder. It was actually invented by a guy in Lincoln, Nebraska, only a few blocks from me, and is sold through QRPKits.com. It sells for about $20, and it takes you about 3 minutes to put it together. Will hold most small boards that you build with. I recommend that you use thin rosin core solder like Kester 44, 031 or smaller gauge. That's the key. 031 or smaller gauge. You got anything thicker, you're more than likely to make solder bridges. Definitely 031 or thinner, especially when you're working on ICs. Sometimes I have two different rolls of solder with me, one for certain kinds of junctions and one's for the real small one. Sharp flush wire cutters and strippers. That's also very essential because if you don't make a nice smooth and sharp cut, sometimes it can push the solder so that it touches the adjacent connection. So you really don't want that. So I recommend getting some very sharp flush wire cutters and strippers. And I have seen those out in the flea market as little as 50 cents. I was really amazed today. Needle nose pliers, once again, doesn't have to cost much, a buck or two. I've seen some real good ones. Now, if you want to be really comfortable about building things, I recommend Exolite tools. They have a nice soft spring to them so you don't end up with hand cramps and so forth. And they have the cutters, strippers, and pliers. Screwdrivers. I never pass up a freebie. You'll find them little screwdrivers that people give away at trade shows and so forth. Many times that's all you need to put something together. But always have a set of screwdrivers. Never use one too big. Never use one too small. Parts tray. First off, I really should have asked at the beginning, how many of you have never built a kit before? There's a couple of you. Very good. I tend to prefer two things at home. One is the muffin tin, and you can get those in sixes. I think sixes, nines, 12s, and 16s, like $3 at Walmart. Actually, it was kind of funny because I went to the store and the lady said, "Are you baking something?" I went and bought three or four different kinds of muffin tins. They actually work good. I would say most small kits, I use a 6-cup tin. Larger kits like my KX1, I used a 12. Keeps your parts sorted out real well. Helpful things to have: a magnifying glass. You get older, you got to have reading glasses. You got to have a magnifying glass. I would not build a kit without some kind of magnifying, because even if your eyesight is good, it's not going to see that hair thin short between two connections. So make sure you've got something that magnifies. And we'll take that one step further: a hobby lamp with a magnifier. Now, what I like to use is a circle light, and they sell these at places like Hobby Lobby and Michael's, Office Depot, Office Max, Staples, all those places sell these things. It's a lamp that's round, and it's on an extension, and it has a fluorescent light that goes around a big round lens. And I like to drop that over what I'm working on and work through that. And that really helps things a lot. And there's another advantage to that, and that is a fluorescent light brings out the colors in resistors a lot better. The color code of the resistors, you can easily mistake a brown for a red for an orange many times if the paint isn't real good quality, but it always seems to look good under bright fluorescent light. So that'll really help you distinguish it and make sure you don't put the wrong resistor in the wrong place. My other recommendation besides the cupcake trays is a tackle box. A tackle box works real well, especially the ones that says that the worms can't get out, because that means your parts can't get out either. What I did was I went over to Cabela's and I picked up a tackle box that has a container on the top that you can put like the boards, the cases, and things like that, and it has four removable trays that come out. And you can shake them up, move them upside down, whatever, and the stuff doesn't go between the trays. And then I label the tray with a sticker that's got the name of the kit that I'm working on. So if I wanted to put away one kit and then go to another kit, I can shove it in the tray and then pull out the other one, set it on the table, unsnap it, and either work out of that or put the parts in the cupcake tin. In sorting parts, what part is the most common part that you use? Resistors. So resistors are the number one. So I always put it in the cup that's closest to me. Okay, so I'm not having to reach over all the way to the back to find a resistor. So I put the resistors in the cup that's closest to me. Next most common, disc caps, small capacitors. The capacitors then go in the next cup. And then so forth, I go through diodes and transistors. Sometimes I lump together, and then ICs. And we work our way back to the nuts, bolts, screws, plugs, jacks, connectors, and stuff that you're either going to use first or last. Those go in the back row. So a lot of times we use the back row first and last when I do it. Now, a muffin fan, I would say smoke gets in your eyes. Yeah, it does. And that's kind of the unpleasant thing about kit building sometimes. So if your room is well ventilated, you don't have to worry about it. I'm kind of fortunate in that my room I share with the washer, the dryer, and the furnace. So there is a lot of air circulation that seems to get through there. So I don't usually worry about it. But if I do, I've taken chip cooler fans out of computers since I fix computers for a living. And I hook it up to the 12-volt supply and just let it blow across. Don't let it blow anywhere near where your board is or your parts are or your instructions, because they'll go flying. But I just put it way off to the back, and it just keeps the air circulating around and doesn't have to be super close to you. And believe it or not, a little tiny fan can move a lot of air. Once you get the smoke away, it's a lot better. A comfortable chair or stool. I like padded bar stools. I've kind of grown fond of those because it matches my bench. Nice and comfortable. Makes it a very, very enjoyable experience. A magnetic rod. I haven't seen any of these here yet, but I'm sure they are. If you go to a tool vendor, it looks like a telescoping antenna. But it's got a real strong magnet on it. As I'm sitting up there on that bar stool, and I drop a part on the floor, well, I'll just go pull that thing out and go, so, I gotcha. It's also good if you drop a nut, bolt, or screw or something like that inside the cabinet. Good for getting things out. Or if something falls in a crack, it gets things out. I actually use one at work when I'm working on computers and printers, especially printers when a screw falls deep into a laser.
You're listening to a talk about the tools of the kit building trade from Nebraska veteran kit builder Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB. We'll conclude his 2007 Dayton Hamvention Forum presentation in a moment. This is RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network.
Batteries or power supply. The worst thing is working on something Sunday night and it's 9 o'clock and you finally get it all put together and oops, I don't have a AA battery. So instead of robbing it out of your garage door opener or something, make sure you got the right batteries that you need, or a power supply, or a connection to your power supply. Everybody's mostly got 12 volt power supplies and a lot of kits run on 12 volts. So what I would suggest to you is having a power supply ready and having a piece of wire or connection or something to make sure you can hook it up. Plugs, jacks, and cables. Once again, if you're building a 1-watt CW transmitter, what are you going to need? You need power, going to need antenna or dummy load. And I suggest a dummy load when you're first working with it. And you're going to need a key, and you're going to need wires to connect them up. So make sure you have all that ready. Sometimes it hooks to something else. Make sure you've got the right kind of plugs, jacks, or connectors to make the right connection to your antenna. Miscellaneous standard parts. There are some people that sell assortments of common values of capacitors, resistors, things like that, certain common diodes. But I would recommend that you have all the different values of capacitors and resistors so that you can make substitutions in case you have a modification. Answering machine or voicemail. People say, what the heck's that got to do with building a kit? Disruptions. Disruptions are the biggest cause of errors when you build kits. So when I'm working on a kit, answering machine or the voicemail, I let the voicemail take my cell phone. I leave it in stun mode. And so I know, yeah, somebody called me. Who cares? And then it'll beep once and says, oh, you got a voicemail. Okay, that's fine. I can answer it later. That way you don't suddenly reach for the phone when you got your soldering iron on the third pin of a 20-pin IC or something. Kids work good too for that, except my kid answers the phone and says, Dad, it's for you. Oh, well, it only delayed it about 5 seconds. So make sure you got an answering machine or voicemail. It really helps. An AM/FM radio. Is that a tool for building kits? You bet it is. Because what I do is I have the radio on a music station. Sorry, don't have them angry talk shows on there because that's all they are, and they're more distracting than anything. Because I always make people upset no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. So what I do is I tune in a music station. What does it do once an hour? On the hour, they give their legal ID. So I look up and it says KRKR Lincoln, 95 Rock. And I look, it's 3 o'clock. Oh, cool. And then they go back to music and I go back to my kit. And pretty soon I put a few more parts on and darn, there's that legal ID again. I look up, it's 4 o'clock. So it helps you keep track of time and it kind of helps set you in the right frame of mind because kit building is fun. It's not work, it's fun. Some nice things to know, ESD procedures. A lot of kits now involve CMOS parts, which are static sensitive. So you want to be really, really careful about handling parts that are static sensitive. There's a whole set of procedures you can look up online. The main thing I do is I ground my little metal cupcake tin, and then if I have a CMOS part in there, I just touch the tin before I pick the part up, and that's neutralized my static potential to be the same as the plate. And that usually gets rid of it. I have the most problem with static in the wintertime because you're raising the heat in the house, the temperature of the house, yet the humidity level is very low. That's not to say that static discharge can't happen in the summer as well because your air conditioner is dehumidifying the house. But if you live in the Midwest or northern states, in the summer you can get static too. In your area, it's always nice and moist. You usually don't have to worry about it, but still be careful of ESD because a lot of times you can zap something and not even feel it. And what voltage does it take to zap an ESD-sensitive device? 30 volts. You'd never know it. 30 volts. The resistor color code. I'm not going to say how I learned that years ago. A lot of you guys know how we learned that. And we can't say that anymore. So what we do is we download a chart that the ARL has and several other organizations have. Of course, it's in the back of the handbook. And there's an online site that has color codes. Sometimes I leave my laptop next to my bench and I can go look at it. But I have a poster, and that's the main thing you use. Make sure you get your resistors right. Sometimes the instructions aren't correct. So that gets us into parts ID and handling. I would suggest watching those little white stripes. Turn a diode backwards, and sometimes it makes a really good flash bulb. So be careful. And tantalum capacitors, if you ever see those used, make a good firecracker if they're hooked in backwards. Electrolytics just kind of burst, but they don't make all the fireworks that tantalums do. Make sure you're careful in the way you place the parts. Follow the instructions so one part doesn't touch another, and make sure the leads aren't touching another, especially when bending transistor leads. Polarity marks, once again, we talked about that, the stripes on the diodes for the anode and the cathode and so forth. Electrolytic caps, make sure you get them in the right way. Schematic symbols. In the ARL handbook is all the schematic symbols, something good to know because you can look at the diagram and figure out how this thing works, and that's half the fun of kit building. The external parts needed, we kind of talked about that before, plugs, jacks, cables, cases, knobs, things like that you might need. Tech support numbers, phone numbers you can call if the manufacturer supports it that way, or instant messaging or email service. Also something that I kind of allude to in email services is reflectors. If you build an Elecraft kit, there's a tremendous email reflector, and I've put a question on there, and within an hour or two, there's a response already that led me right to the bad part. So that's really worthwhile. Don, W3FPR, is kind of a one-man band on there. He knows everything that goes wrong. It's also good to have friends. A second set of eyes always helps, especially friends who are technicians or access to labs. If I'm lucky, I can take it over to the Telex lab in Lincoln and get something analyzed. But it's good to have test equipment such as an oscilloscope, and I've seen these for sale used very cheap now. Frequency counters, I've seen those well under $100 here. Signal generators, a lot of times you can build that from a kit. I know Elecraft has one that's inexpensive that puts out a signal that not only is a nice 1 microvolt signal, it puts out 50 microvolts, which is, guess what? It's S9. So you can calibrate any rig with it by using that as a source. A dummy load is also very good. W0XI, who will be here in a little bit, has several different dummy loads that he makes that'll even tell you how much power it's putting out. And it lights up lights using the RF as the power supply. To give you some more hints, go slow. Take your time. Don't get too anxious. A lot of times I used to do that because I didn't have enough time to sit down there and do it when I was working a lot of hours. So go slow. Take your time. Remove the distractions. I have two distractions that have whiskers. They like to jump up on the bench when I'm building a kit. And I told the one cat, he just looks at me, you know, just comes up and he starts sniffing at me. And he just looks at that soldering iron. And I said, listen, you get anything closer to that thing, and you're going to get fixed twice. Keep your parts sorted out. Make sure the diodes are with diodes and transistors with them, and your resistors and so forth. If you're building a kit that has more resistors than you can sort through in one cup, use a second cup. Use a second cup of your tin or your tackle box. Like low values in one, high values in another. Carefully ID and handle your parts. Follow the directions. Even if it's just a simple diagram or a very elaborate manual like Elecraft puts out, in the computer world, we say read the fine manual. Is that what we really say in the computer world? Keep your soldering iron tip clean. I can't emphasize that enough because dirty tips make dirty connections. Keep a collection of common spare parts handy, not just the ones that go on the board, but parts that might go outside the board, like extra connectors. Desoldering tools, have those ready too. They can be as elaborate as the Hayco type vacuum desoldering tools, and they can be as simple as a vacuum bulb and your regular soldering iron or solder wick. Make sure you have them ready. One of the hints that I give to people that have never soldered or desoldered is I'll give them an old board from a box I have at work from old mainframe computers. And I'll take them and I'll say, okay, let's take this part off the board. And I show them how to use solder wick. I show them how to use solder suckers and different things. We take that part off. Then guess what we do? We put it back. And now they learn how to solder it back. And so they've learned how to get a part off a board without breaking it and put it back. Like if you put a part in the wrong position. Always a good skill to have. Keep your bench area clear and relax. This is fun. This is our handcrafts. This is what us hams do. There are people that their wives will go to a place like Michael's or Hobby Lobby and they buy all this stuff and they set up a tray in front of the TV and they watch TV and they sew or make different types of craft items. Well, this is what we do, except for the solder smoke probably gets in the way of TV watching.
That was Nebraska veteran kit builder Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB, as excerpted from his 2007 Dayton Hamvention Forum talk. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2007. RAIN. All rights reserved. Now for RAIN's founder-producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Byron Lee, KC9EEK, wishing you a very 73 from all of us at RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network. www.therainreport.com